They are investigating the area, she said, keeping her voice calm and mild.
Nah, they're not. They're poking and prodding, and Azeroth doesn't like it. She needs to heal, or she's gone to die.
All present listened intently as the speaker explained that Azeroth was in agony, racked by pain that was slowly destroying her. Her very essence was seeping to the surface, and this essence was powerful beyond imagining. The last part Sylvanas already knew. The first was troubling.
We've got to help her,
Magni said, his voice ragged, and this time she did not correct him.
Of course we must, she said. This revelation could undo everything. I assume you will speak to the Alliance.
Already done,
Magni said, clearly hoping to reassure her.
Young Anduin and the Explorers League, the Cenarian Circle and the Earthen Ring are gone to be sending out teams to Silithus soon.
The Magni Bronzebeard who once had ruled Ironforge would never have revealed what this speaker of Azeroth just had. This was valuable information.
Good, said Bane. We stand ready to do the same.
He should not have spoken before his war chief, but Sylvanas was starting to get an idea.
High Chieftain Bane speaks for us all. What you have shared is grave news indeed, Speaker. Of course we will do what we can to help. In fact, she continued, I would like to ask the Tauren to organize the Horde response.
Bane blinked twice, but otherwise gave no indication of how surprised he doubtless was.
It will be an honor, he said, and brought his fist to his heart in a salute.
Thank you for your warning, Speaker. We all exist on this precious world, and as recent events have brought home to all of us, there are not many places left for us to flee to should we destroy this one, Sylvanas said.
That's mighty enlightened of you, Magni allowed. Right then, me task is far from over. I know the members of the Horde and the Alliance both have trouble imagining that they aren't the only people in the world. But there are many other races I must warn. As you say, War Chief, we all exist on this precious world. Call off your goblins, or else we might be trying to find an entirely new world to call home.
Sylvanas did not promise she would, but she smiled.
Please, let us save you some time as you execute this task. Where may Arandis send you next?
Desolus, I think, Magni mused. Need to tail the centaur. Thank you, lassie.
Sylvanas kept the pleasant smile on her face even as she seethed at the too familiar, condescending term. All were quiet as Arandis conjured a portal that opened up onto the bare, ugly land, and Magni stepped through it and vanished.
Hamul sighed deeply. It is worse even than I feared, he said. We must begin work as soon as we can. High Chieftain, we all need those who have worked with the Alliance before to...
No.
The War Chief's voice cut off the conversation with the efficiency of a blade lopping off a head.
War Chief, Bane said calmly. We all heard the words of the speaker. Azeroth is badly wounded. Have we forgotten the lessons of the Cataclysm already?
Tails swished. Ears were lowered and flicked. The trolls looked down and shook their heads. Oh yes, they all remembered the Cataclysm.
Such a thing cannot be permitted to happen a second time.
I should have done this a long time ago, Sylvanas thought.
She rose fluidly and went to the Tauren leader.
I have words for your ears only, High Chieftain, she said, her voice a purr. Walk with me.
Bane's ears flattened against his head for a moment, but he nodded and descended the steps that led from the teepee to the rise. The rises of Thunderbluff, Spirit Rise, Elder Rise, and Hunter Rise were all connected to the center rise by rope bridges and planks. Sylvanas marveled quietly at the engineering. They seemed so rickety and precarious, yet they easily handled the weight of several Tauren crossing at a time. Sylvanas walked without hesitation to the middle of the bridge. It swayed slightly. From there she could see the faint glow of the cavern that housed the pools of vision. Before she left, she would have to pay a visit there. It was the only congregation of Forsaken in the Tauren capital. She needed to return home to the Undercity too, to meet with the Desolate Council. to assess the threat, or lack thereof, for herself.
What are these words you wish to share with me, War Chief?
Bane asked. Are my people happy here? The Tauren cocked his head in puzzlement.
I believe so, he said. They have all that they ask for and seem content.
The Tauren befriended the Forsaken when we were rejected by the Alliance. For that, I will always be grateful. Hamul Runtotem, currently a thorn in her side, had argued successfully that the Forsaken were capable of redeeming themselves. With free will, they could choose to atone for what they had done after being murdered and enslaved to the Lich King's will. He had convinced the War Chief Thrall, who knew a thing or two about people being seen as monsters, to admit the Forsaken into the Horde. Sylvanas would never forget that. She turned to Bane now, looking up at him. And for that, I have looked the other way when you pursued a friendship with a certain human.
My interaction with Jaina Proudmoore has long been known, Bane said. It was made public knowledge at Garrosh Hellscream's trial. She aided me when the Grim Totem were in rebellion against the Tauren. Why does this trouble you now?
That doesn't trouble me. What does trouble me is that you have continued to exchange correspondence with Anduin Rin. Do you deny it? He was silent, but his suddenly switching tale betrayed him. Tauren were terrible liars. At last he spoke.
I have never, by word or implication, advocated anything that would bring harm to the Horde.
I believe you. That is why I have not interfered ere now. But Prince Anduin is now King Anduin. He's no longer an ineffectual starry-eyed dreamer. He is the maker of policy. He can start a war. If you were me, would you condone secret messages sent to an Alliance king?
What will you do?
Bane asked with remarkable calmness. Nothing, she said. As long as the connection is severed. And to show I do not hold a grudge at what some could understandably label treason, I stand by my offer to allow you to lead the response to help heal Azeroth. In fact, she gestured to the cavern entrance below them. I will speak with the Forsaken here and see if the pools of vision can be of any assistance. I will leave my ranger Syndia behind. She will keep me advised of all developments. She turned back to Bane. He stood as still as if he were a statue of a Tauren. Even his tail had stopped twitching. Do we understand each other?
Perfectly, War Chief. Is that all?
It is. I hope this conversation marks the beginning of a new level of cooperation between the Tauren and the Forsaken. Bane followed her, a looming hulk of silence as they returned to the teepee. She informed those who were waiting there of her suggestion that the Forsaken of the Pools of Vision work with the Tauren as they sought to heal the world. When Hamul spoke of a new Cenarian hold in Silithus, one of the trolls spoke up.
And what of the goblins? They be there thick as flies, the troll said. You're gonna pull them out like the speaker said.
The goblins, said Sylvanas, know about the deep places of the world better than any other members of the Horde. I have spoken with Gallywix, and he assures me that they are exploring and investigating. When it appeared as though several were ready to object to this, she forestalled them by saying, He reports directly to me, and when I am ready, I will share what I have learned with the Horde.
But not the Alliance, Runtotem said.
Sylvanas very carefully did not look at Bane as she replied. Magni has already spoken to the Alliance. I am quite certain Anduin will not be sending couriers to Orgrimmar with their latest discoveries. Why should I?
Because this world belongs to all of us, Runtotem said quietly.
Sylvanas smiled. Perhaps one day soon, all of us will mean Horde. In the meantime, I put the interests and welfare of my people before the Alliance who destroyed Taraho. I suggest all of you do as well.
But, the Archdruid began.
She turned to him, her face cold, composed, but her eyes hot, angry fire. Object again, and I will not take it well. Vol'jin and his Loa named me the War Chief of the Horde, and as War Chief of the Horde, I decide what is important to reveal, and when, And to whom is that understood?
Hamul's ears flattened against his skull, but he spoke calmly enough.
Yes, War Chief.
The Undercity.
Parkwall Fentalis had been a historian when he still drew breath. He'd known all there was to know about Lordaeron, and remembered, with a great deal of fondness, time spent with his wife Mina and his daughter Philia, in his modest but comfortable chambers in Capital City. Even now, he could recall the smell of the ink and the parchment as he scribbled notes from various musty old tomes, and the golden honey hue of the light that filtered in. The crackle of the fire, warm and comforting, as he worked late into the night by the light of candles. Sometimes Mina would send in Philia to deliver his supper when he was too engrossed to come to the table. He'd pull her onto his lap when she was young, and invite her to sit with him when she was older, encouraging her to browse through the massive library while he feasted on Mina's excellent cooking. But there was no crackling fire here in the Undercity, no smells of parchment and ink and delicious food prepared with love by a warm and wise life-mate. No child to pester him with questions he'd love to answer. Only coldness, dampness, the sickly smell of rot, and the eerie green glow of the tainted river that flowed throughout the subterranean necropolis. Those memories were too fresh to be anything but painful, yet how sweet they still were. The Forsaken were strongly discouraged from revisiting places they had loved in life. Their home was no longer Lordaeron, but the Undercity, a place that, like the inhabitants who no longer had need of sleep, didn't distinguish between day and night. Once or twice, Parkwall had sneaked into his former lodgings, smuggling books into the Undercity. But he had been caught once and admonished. His books had been confiscated. There is no need to remember the human history of this place, he had been told. Only the history of the Undercity matters now. Over the years, he'd made use of adventurers to acquire more books, each one precious to him. But he could not use adventurers who sought gold or fame to bring back what had gone. Mina was either dead or a gibbering monstrosity. And Philia, his bright, beautiful girl, was still human, possibly still alive. But even so, she would be horrified at what had become of her beloved papa. For the longest time, he had thought himself unique in his wistfulness. But then Velsinda had founded the Desolate Council to take care of the city in the Dark Lady's absence. What had begun purely as necessity had, for Parkwall at least, become something so much more. It had given him a sense of camaraderie and the knowledge that not everyone was content simply to serve without questioning. The Forsaken might not be living, but they had needs, desires, emotions that were not being met. Velsinda believed that Sylvanas would visit soon and would listen to what the council had to say. Parkwall sincerely hoped she was right, but he had his doubts. Sylvanas needed to stop forcing them to live again if they did not wish to. She needed to allow them to embrace their former lives as well as their undeath. History taught that those who had power were generally loath to relinquish any of it unless they were forced to do so. And in all his years of life and undeath, Parkwall had seldom found history's lessons to be wrong.
Chapter 13. Darnassus. The capital of the Night Elves was one of Anduin's favorite places, though he had seldom been able to travel there. The Calderai were a beautiful people, and so was their city, nestled securely in the embrace of the massive world tree, Teldrassil. Anduin now stood beside High Priestess Tyrande Whisperwind and her beloved, the Archdruid Malfurion Stormrage, in the Temple of the Moon. Serenity enveloped this place as the tenders of the temple went about their duties with grace and purpose. The rhythmic sound of softly splashing water was soothing, and the statue of Haydeen holding aloft the bowl from which the moonwell's radiant liquid flowed was calming to behold. His mind went back to the Netherlight Temple. The light finds us, he thought. All of us. It chooses the story, or the face, or the name or the song that resonates the most with each of us. We may call it a loon, or Anshe, or just the light, but it doesn't matter. We can turn away from it if we desire, but it's always there. He caught Tyrande watching him,
a slight smile curving her lips. She understood. "I regret that I have not been a more frequent visitor to your beautiful city," he said aloud. "War by its nature conspires to keep us all from places that nurture the spirit," Tyrande said. With a sigh, Anduin turned away from the statue and faced the pair of leaders. "My letter outlined the nature of the current battle we face," he said. "A battle to heal our world. Has Magni come to you yet?"
"Not yet," Maltherian said. "It is a wide world, and speaker for it he may be, but there is much ground to cover. We had already sent members of the Cenarian Circle back to Silithus after the tragedy. We wanted to assess the damage."
"We have eyes on it," Shaw had told him earlier. "Not for the first time, and I'm certain not for the last. I am grateful for the strong bonds between our peoples," Anduin said. "What did the Circle learn?"
The two exchanged a look. Then, "Come," said Maltherian. "Let us ride."
Anduin walked with them through the springy grass of the temple and out the arched doorway. Two sentinels, the fierce female soldiers who guarded the city, awaited them with three nightsabers.
"Do you know how to ride one?" Tyrande asked with a smile.
"I've ridden griffins, hippogriffs, and horses," Anduin said, "but not a nightsaber."
"They are similar to a griffin, but with a smoother gait. I think you will enjoy it."
There was a spotted black one that had a soft gray coat, and a white one with black stripes that reminded the young king of the great white tiger Zhuan, whom he had met in Pandaria. Too much so, he felt it would almost be disrespectful to ride it. He opted for the gray one, swinging himself into the saddle with ease. The big cat looked back at him, grunted, and shook its head before settling into a rhythmic lope that was as comfortable as Tyrande had promised.
"I believe it is as grim as the speaker made it out to be," Maltherian said as the three made their way down the carpeted ramp and over the white marble stone heading away from the temple.
He kept his voice pitched softly.
"Everyone in the Cenarian hold and throughout the region was killed at once."
"I sent priestesses when I heard," Tyrande said, and left it at that.
Anduin thought bleakly of the horrifying sight that must have greeted the gentle sisters of Alun. More than the world was wounded by Sargeras. The only consolation was that the Mad Titan had, after so long cutting a swath of destruction and torment throughout the universe, finally been imprisoned.
"Our first thought was to send groups of druids and priestesses to create moonwells," Maltherian continued.
It made good sense. Moonwells contained sacred waters that could heal wounds and restore energy and vitality, and they often were put to use purifying corrupted areas, or in this case, healing wounded ones. "Did you meet with success?" Anduin asked.
"It is too early to tell. Most of our groups have not even had an opportunity to create one. The goblins are hard at work plundering Azeroth," Maltherian said, his normally pleasant deep voice a rumble of wounded anger. "And there is plenty for them to exploit. As Magni told you, the essence of the world has come to the surface, and in great supply. We found ourselves a vein."
A vein. Anduin's mind went immediately to the intricate network of veins and arteries that went through a living body. Strange how so long ago, well before anyone understood that Azeroth was a sleeping, nascent titan, the term vein had been used to describe the ribbons of various minerals that ran throughout the world. Maltherian turned his black-striped nightsaber to the right, heading toward the warrior's terrace. As they passed the citizens of Darnassus, many turned to regard the sight of the young Stormwind King, bowing and waving to him. Anduin smiled and returned the waves, although the subject matter he was discussing with the Darnassian onlookers' leaders was a bleak one.
"We obtained some samples to study," Maltherian continued. "It is."
The archdruid, Anduin knew, was well over 10,000 years old, yet this substance left him at a loss for words. For a moment, the night elf seemed almost overcome. Riding closely beside and in perfect synchronization with her husband, Tyrande reached out to him, squeezing his arm briefly in silence. Anduin regarded Maltherian with deep sympathy.
"I have held it," he said quietly. "I know how it affected me. I cannot imagine how it must have moved those so deeply connected to nature and the land."
"I cannot deny the magnificence of it, or the power, for good,
or ill. And Tyrande and I, all the Kaldurai, will do everything we can to prevent its misuse.
The warrior's terrace loomed up ahead. At the top, standing at attention, a unit of 5 sentinels awaited them. Their leader was an elf with long, dark blue hair pulled back in a ponytail. Her skin was pale reddish-purple, and the traditional markings on her face looked like claw marks. Like all her sisters, she was strong and lithe and fierce. But unlike many of the sentinels Anduin had met before, she did not have a hardened expression. Tyrande slipped off her saber and greeted the sentinel warmly. Anduin and Malfurion too dismounted. One hand on the sentinel's shoulder, Tyrande turned to her guest.
King Anduin Rin, she said, and Anduin realized that it would take a long time for him to grow used to that title. May I present Captain Cordressa Briarbow?
The captain turned to Anduin and inclined her head.
I am honored, she said.
A pleasure, Captain, Anduin said.
I remember you from the trial in Pandaria.
She smiled.
I am flattered you recall.
We have been in communication with the Explorers League, Tyrande said. Ordinarily they provide their own protection. But given the state of Silithus at this moment, I have offered them the aid of Cordressa's unit. Her eyes flashed. Goblins are not to be trifled with, and with them present in so many numbers, the area is dangerous.
A wise decision, Anduin said. I am certain there will be several expeditions. I will assign some of my units to protective duty as well.
Anduin was no lover of war, but he knew that others thrived on combat. This would allow them to utilize their training in a positive way.
Druids and shaman can take care of themselves, Malfurion said. But the members of the Explorers League are generally archaeologists and scientists, and right now they are doing precious work.
Their attention was drawn by a soft swirl of white a few feet away, accompanied by the distinctive sound of a portal opening. A moment later, a gnome, all eyebrows and mustache, stepped through. Gold embroidery on his violet tabard depicted the all-seeing eye that was the symbol of the Kirin Tor. What did the most powerful Magi in Azeroth want with Tyrande and Malfurion? Anduin wondered. But when the gnome trundled directly up to him, the king realized it wasn't the leaders of Darnassus that the Kirin Tor had come to see.
Greetings, High Priestess, Archdruid, the gnome said, nodding to the much bigger Night Elves. King Anduin, this message is for you.
Thank you. Light, please let this not be more bad news. Our poor world cannot handle it.
He broke the seal and read, feeling all eyes on him.
To Anduin Rin, King of Stormwind, Kalikos of the Kirin Tor gives greetings. Your Majesty, I hope this finds you well. I understand you embarked on a journey to thank your fellow Alliance members for their role in winning a terrible war. It is exactly the sort of thing I would expect of you, my friend, and I hope it goes well. Our mutual friend paid me an unexpected visit just now. I believe we will not be seeing her again anytime soon. But I have faith that she will return, and her mind will be the calmer and clearer for her retreat from this world. It is difficult to heal when a wound is constantly being reopened. I know nothing about where she will be, but I felt you would wish to hear.
Kay.
Is all well, Your Majesty? Malfurion asked quietly.
It was overall good news. At the same time, Anduin again regretted that Jaina still seemed to be lost. He hoped, as Kallak did, that she would find the answers and the peace she sought.
Yes, he said. An update on a personal matter. Nothing dire.
Do you wish me to carry a response? The gnome courier inquired.
You may tell Kalikos that I have received the message, and I share his hopes.
Thank you. The gnome nodded.
Good day, then.
His small hands made motions that Anduin could not quite follow, and the air before the courier shimmered. Anduin caught a glimpse of the beautiful floating city of Dalaran for just an instant, then the gnome stepped through the portal. It faded behind him. Anduin turned to Malfurion and Tyrande.
The letter concerned Jaina, he said. She is safe, according to Kalikos.
That is good news, Tyrande said. Though, it makes me wonder why she did not choose to fight alongside us against the Legion after the Broken Shore. Will she be returning? Anduin shook his head. Not immediately, at any rate. Hopefully, one day.
And may that day be soon, Malfurion said. The world needs all the champions it can find.
It does, Anduin said, slowly, thinking. His plan had been to rendezvous with Velen at the Exodar. He had spent much time there a few years earlier, and it was the closest thing he had to his second home. He yearned to walk its crystalline halls once more, and to speak with the warm, friendly Draenei. But Velen had already enlightened the Draenei about what Magni had revealed in Ironforge. Down to the littlest one, they were all probably hard at work already. The Exodar and Velen did not need him right now. His task was to spread the news to others and spur them on to action. And that was a task he could not do alone. Anduin made a decision. He would not be traveling to the Exodar. He would return to Stormwind briefly, and then he would travel to the third place that in his heart he felt he could call home. The Netherlight Temple. Chapter 14. Stormwind. It was very late when Anduin returned from Teldrassil. He used his hearthstone to avoid disturbing anyone. Will had been asleep for several hours, and Anduin didn't feel like getting into discussions with Gen Greymane just yet. There was, however, someone he did very much wish to speak with, and he wanted to give her a chance to report with news before he left for the Netherlight Temple. He had materialized in the receiving room where he and his father had shared so many meals, arguments, and discussions. A ghost of a smile touched his lips, along with the ache of loss. Then he turned and went to his private quarters, lit a candle, and placed it in the window. That task done, he tended to another one, filling his growling stomach. After descending into the kitchen, quiet at this hour, he heaped a plate with bread, Dalaran sharp, and golden bark apples. When Anduin returned to his chambers, he closed the door behind him and said, "I'll feel silly if I'm talking to myself." "You're not." Valyra was there. Anduin started to smile, then saw the expression on her face. All at once, he lost his appetite. "Something's wrong," he said. When she didn't deny it, Anduin's heart sank. "Tell me." She closed her eyes, then mutely handed him a letter. For a moment, Anduin didn't want to read it. He wanted to stay in this place of innocent ignorance. But that was not granted to a king, not one who wanted to be a good leader of his people, at any rate. He swallowed hard. "Is he safe?" "For the moment." Valyra jerked her head at the letter. At least the worst hasn't happened, Anduin thought. But he suspected he knew what was in the letter now. With a heavy heart, he unfolded the letter, which was written in the agreed-upon code. He translated it as he read. "For years I have cherished our friendship. I cherish it still. But with great reluctance, and for the sake of those who look to me for protection, I know the time has come when I must sever it." Anduin's stomach clenched. "She knows." He continued reading. "I will not put my people, nor you, friend, at further risk. I still believe that there will come a day when we can speak openly with the support of all our people. But that day has not yet come. Earth Mother, watch over you." Anduin had half expected this once Sylvanas had become leader of the Horde, but even so, it felt like a physical blow. Ever since the day he had accidentally materialized in the middle of a meeting between Bane Bloodhoof and Jaina Proudmoore, he had liked the Tauren leader. Like Bane, Anduin had thought they were friends. But all at once he was besieged by doubt. Bane had expressed his sympathies about Varian's death, reminding Anduin that he too had lost a father. The initial reports from Gen Greymane and others were that Sylvanas had betrayed them, abandoning Varian and presumably every other member of the Alliance to die when she retreated with no warning from the Broken Shore. Bane, who had been there, had told Anduin a different story. Another wave of demons had appeared, he said, and Sylvanas reported that a dying Vol'jin had ordered her to sound the retreat. Had Bane lied to him? No. Anduin's heart was sore, but there was no warning of danger or deceit from his once shattered bones. Bane had told the truth as he knew it. Yet no one but Sylvanas, it seemed, had actually heard the order from Vol'jin. "I will not let Sylvanas tarnish my faith in Bane," he thought resolutely. With a deep sigh, he rose and tossed the letter into the fire, watching as the flames flared brightly and reduced the parchment to a blackened, writhing ball, and then to ashes. "Did Perith accept my letter?" Anduin asked, forcing his voice to be calm and level. "No," Valera replied, another gut punch. He thought it would endanger his chieftain. There are eyes upon him. "Perith is very wise," Anduin replied. "But he said he would tell Bane what the letter said." I had so hoped that Bane would support my plan. He may yet. Or he may do nothing that smacks of disloyalty. I can't blame him. I'd do the same. A leader who jeopardizes his people is no leader at all. Anduin kept his gaze on the flames. Valera stepped beside him. "There is one thing more," she said. "Bane wanted you to have this." She extended her hand. A small piece of what looked like bone, no larger than Anduin's fingernail, rested in her gloved palm. It took Anduin a few seconds to comprehend what he was looking at, and when he did, his breath caught. This was a piece of Bane's horn, chipped off in an offering of respect and friendship. His hand closed slowly around it. "I'm sorry, Anduin. I know what a disappointment this is." She did, too. He looked down at her, smiling sadly, recalling the days not so long ago when she was much taller than he was. "I know," he said, "and I thank you for it. For everything. It seems each passing day reduces the number of people I can rely on." "I hope you will always count me among that group," Valera said. "Never doubt that," Anduin assured her. Her eyes searched his for a moment. "You are a kind person, Anduin. It is in your nature to think the best of people. But you're also a king," Valera said quietly. "You cannot afford to trust unwisely." "No," he agreed sadly. "I can't." They stood by the fire in silence for a long time. Silithus. The two moons were out tonight. Safraneta Flivers, peering up at them after a long day of travel and setting up camp, said to her companion,
"You know, they're really very beautiful."
The Night Elf Sentinel, Cordressa Briarbow, said, "Do you know their names?" Heat came into the gnome's round face.
One of them is the blue, something.
At the Night Elf's soft chuckle, Safi blushed even more deeply. Her former husband had always told her how cute she was when she blushed, which Safi detested and which made her flush, not blush, with anger whenever he said it. Which, of course, just made him happier.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I've spent almost my whole life underground or in a lab, you see. I'm afraid I don't get outside very much."
"You are well versed in so very many things I could never understand, Safraneta," Cordressa said gently. "No one can know everything."
"Try telling that to my ex-husband."
Again the soft chuckle. "The moons are named the Blue Child and the White Lady, the child's mother. The White Lady has different names. My people call her Ilun. The Tauren call her Musha. Once every 430 years, something truly marvelous occurs. The moons align with one another, and for a few precious, glorious moments, it looks as though the lady is holding her child. Our world is bathed in a blue-white radiance, and time itself seems to stand still if you look upon it with an open heart." Gazing at the beautiful orbs, Safi let out a soft breath of awe.
"When did it last happen?"
she asked, wondering if she'd learned this interesting tidbit in time to witness the event. 5 years ago." Safi's face fell.
"Oh," she said. "Guess I probably won't be around to see it."
The long-lived elf, who probably would be around to see it, did not reply. "But you can see them both now in the beautiful clear sky of the desert." That was probably the first time Safi had heard the word beautiful to describe anything concerning Silithus. Even before it had a gargantuan sword sticking out of it, by all accounts it was a hideous place. Her gaze traveled to the sword now. It was hard to miss. Not only was it humongous, but it was surrounded by a creepy aura of red light, so it was an eyesore at any time of day and night. The black monstrosity had been plunged halfway into the poor ground. Steaming fissures had been revealed, yielding the mysterious Azurite in its two forms. Fluid, and hardened blue-gold chunks. Safi was more than a little frustrated that Mechatork and Bran Bronzebeard had sent her off on the expedition before she'd had a chance to actually touch the stuff. Their notes were useful, but she couldn't wait to see and feel the substance herself. And the desert that surrounded the sword was hot, filled with insects of all shapes and sizes, cultists, mysterious things lurking in ruins. That was beautiful? Well, all right. Safi could agree that the sky was beautiful. She sneaked a glance upward at her companion, her face upturned and bathed with light as she smiled slightly. Other members of the Explorers League, too, had paused to regard the pair of moons. Again, Safi looked up at them as well. How could they be so placid, the blue child and the white lady? Just sailing through the night sky, blissfully unaware that below them a giant sword was sticking out of the world. That was when Safi realized she'd spoken out loud. She clapped a hand over her mouth, expecting laughter or chastisement for her outburst. She was surprised when Cordressa placed a gentle hand on her shoulder, having to stoop to do so. "You but say what we all think," she said. "Their peace is enviable. But we know better. In a way, I envy the druids of the Cenarian Circle and the shaman of the Earthen Ring. They are looking at means to help Azeroth directly. That must be very gratifying." Now it was Safi's turn to reassure the Night Elf.
"The Explorers League has a role here, too. Last time things went bad in this place, it's because something very old got riled up."
She stabbed a finger in the direction of the sword.
"Magni told us that Azeroth was hurting. But we also don't know how deep that thing goes. What Sargeras might have disturbed or awoken that's also contributing to her distress. And this time, we're walking right into an area that we know to be dangerous. High Priestess Tyranda and you are helping Azeroth by protecting us."
Us. It was Safi's first expedition, though she'd been a consultant member back at the Hall of Explorers for a while. The whole thing was terribly exciting, though that was tempered by the proximity of so many goblins. Cordressa smiled down at her.
"I have not worked much with your people," she said. "But if you are a typical representative of the gnomes, I clearly need to rectify that."
Safi blushed again.
"We all just do what we can," she said.
She had been tapped because she was a well-recognized geologist specializing in mineralogy. The archaeologists on the team would be looking for old gods, ancient doomsday technology, the usual sorts of things. Safi had been brought into the mix specifically to study Azerite. Provided they could actually get to any Azerite. The goblins, oh, how she hated goblins, were squatting on the visible seams of the stuff and conducting eye-hurtingly ugly mining forays. For the last 2 days, the League members had stayed safely away, observing with the telescopes and various contraptions with which Mechatork had furnished them. Frustrating and crude as this method was, Safi already had learned a great deal from her observation. For one thing, Azerite was liquid when it bled from the earth, turning solid only when it was exposed to air. Fascinating. The other thing was that the ground near the sword was warm all the time, not just during daylight hours. Deserts had wildly fluctuating temperatures, from scorching in the day to, if not exactly chilly, at least considerably colder at night. Not Silithus. Not now. Safi was itching to get her hands on more of the material. She'd been added to the team after the Stormwind King had visited Ironforge, leaving with them only a small chunk to study. The next task would be to send out scouts to obtain more samples of Azerite, preferably from a variety of locales. Then Safi would get to do what she loved to do, analyze, study, and understand. It pained, physically pained her to think about all those goblins messing around with this precious substance. The only value it had to them was how they could transmute gold liquid into gold coins. Goblins. How could anyone stand doing business with them? Filthy things. It was all about the boom and the flash and the noise, not the science of it all.
"Your thoughts are not happy ones, Safranetta," Cordressa said.
Safi realized that although her face was still turned up to the moons, she was scowling.
"Come, let us eat something. Then some of my sister's sentinels will stay and guard you while you sleep."
"Some?"
The Night Elf smiled, her eyes glowing in the darkness as brightly as the moons did.
"Some.
and some others will begin the first scouting mission. That made sense. The Kaldurai were called Night Elves for a reason, other than the twilight hues of their skin and hair. They were used to hunting in the nighttime hours. Safi was thrilled.
Maybe you will return with some samples I can study.
Maybe. Although I expect samples will come later. You must cultivate patience. More likely, we will return tonight with information on the enemy's numbers and locations. Maybe intel on their plans, too. Smiling impishly, she tapped one long purple ear. Not only do we see well, we hear well, too. Safi laughed. Dinner, as was always the case whenever dwarves were involved, was hearty, stick-to-your-ribs fare washed down with plenty of beer. Safi didn't want to think too hard about what was beer-basted out here. She'd heard one of the sentinels talking fondly about the gooey spider legs she'd grown up on, and that had been quite enough. After the meal, two sentinels, including Cordressa, slipped quietly out into the warm night. The leader of the expedition, Gavin Stoutarm, gathered the five members of the League and addressed them.
"We're a tight-knit bunch," he said, "and we're not too accustomed to Night Elves being part of our number."
Although the Explorers League was open to all races of the Alliance, it seemed to appeal mostly to humans and dwarves, with the odd gnome or worgen showing up now and then. Night Elves were a rare sight, as they were usually against disturbing the Earth for the purpose of removing artifacts from where they lay hidden.
"I'm proud of how y'all have interacted with them. We're all on this poor world together, and we're all pulling together. No offense to other guards we've had, but I for one will be sleeping sounder than usual tonight."
"Oh, Gavin, you'll be sleeping sounder because you drank about 6 pints of brew."
Guffaws filled the night air with Gavin Stoutarm, who certainly had indulged his thirst, laughing the loudest.
"Off to your bedrolls with you," he said.
Despite the reassuring words, Safi found sleep elusive. She tossed and turned, first in her bedroll and then on it. It was so terribly hot, and then back in it because she realized that outside the bedroll meant insects and sand. She huddled, sweltering, listening to the loud nighttime sounds of four dwarves snoring loudly enough to wake the dead. It was a good thing there were sentinels standing guard, she thought. Stoutarm's wheezing and snorting otherwise would have brought the goblins down on them in droves just to shut him up. Safi must have been more tired than she thought. Somewhere between the snores and the insects and the heat and the sand, she drifted off to sleep. She awoke to the hideous sound of goblin bellowing, the crack of rifles, and the clang of steel against steel. Bolting upright, struggling to escape the confining swaths of fabric, Safi went for the pistol she kept under her pillow and scrambled to her feet. Her heart thudded wildly in her chest as she glanced about frantically, barely able to take in the scene playing out before her. The moon's light, so pleasant and calming earlier, now seemed cold and uncaring as it illuminated the bodies of two dead sentinels. Their blood looked black in the pale blue light, and the glow had fled their eyes, leaving them dark pools of shadow. There was another body, too, a body Safi didn't want to look at, for fear the panic that was clawing at the back of her brain would swoop to the forefront and shut down her ability to think. Safi, think. Her former husband had insisted that she have a weapon. She told him she'd take a lab over an arsenal any day, but right now she wished she'd practiced with the thing. Why hadn't she taken her Lightning Blast 3000 with her? She'd actually gotten it working. Safi gripped the pistol with small, shaking hands, jerking it around toward the noise of each new horror that unfolded. Loud, fierce, dwarven swearing brought a rush of joyful tears to her eyes. Gavin Stoutarm, at least, was still alive and kicking, and punching and biting from the angry sound of a squealing goblin. The gnome's soft mouth set in a hard line. She forced her hands to stop shaking and focused not on the awful, gut-wrenching sounds her friends made as they were fighting and dying. "Safi, they're dying." And she pointed the pistol at a squat, large-eared shape that was blotting out the horizon's stars. She squeezed the trigger. There was a gratifying shout of pain. The resulting boom had knocked her back, and she scrambled to her feet, only to discover to her horror that the goblin hadn't been dispatched, but was merely enraged.
"Why, you little—"
Safi fired again, but this time the shot went wide as the dark shape reached out and seized her arm. He squeezed it hard, and with a gasp of fear and fury, the mineralogist was forced to drop the gun.
Hey, Kezik, that's a gnome lady.
Yeah, Safi's assailant said, making a fist and drawing back his arm. And I'm gonna punch the living...
Oh.
The fist paused in mid-motion.
Maybe she's not the right one.
She fits the description perfectly. You know the rules.
Yeah, yeah.
Stupid rules, the goblin named Kezik muttered. He lowered his fist. Safi took the opportunity to squirm, simultaneously attempting to twist free and bite the muscled arm. Kezik shrieked in pain but didn't release her.
Okay, you little spitfire. All bets are off.
The last thing Saffronetta Flivers saw was a huge dark fist silhouetted against the too calm, too dispassionate night sky. Chapter 15. The Netherlight Temple. The sense of peace that stole over Anduin as he entered the Netherlight Temple was balm to a spirit still wounded from Valyra's news regarding Bane. It felt as if someone had tucked a thick, warm blanket around him while he lay cold and shivering. He smiled softly to himself, and once again marveled at the light's ability to comfort. Archbishop Thau glanced up from an old tome he'd been perusing as Anduin approached. The glow in his dead eyes increased with pleasure, and his lips twisted in a smile.
Anduin, he exclaimed in that curiously warm voice, obviously remembering that the King of Stormwind had asked him not to use the formal title. I had not expected to see you again quite so soon. Sit down, sit down.
He gestured to a chair beside him. Anduin returned the forsaken smile with one of his own, accepting the offered seat. Even as he did so, he mentally shook his head. Sitting comfortably beside a forsaken, it was something he'd never really thought would happen. If only everyone could experience the peace of the Netherlight Temple, he thought. Maybe then we'd stop trying to kill one another. Foul chuckled, that raspy sound, as of two pieces of parchment rubbing together.
Tell me about your visit to Teldrassil.
A blood elf priest approached with a bottle of fruit nectar and a glass. Anduin thanked him. Pouring, he said, The night elves can always be relied on to care for the world. By the time I visited Darnassus, they had already dispatched several groups of priestesses and druids into Silithus to create moonwells.
Ah, moonwells. I never saw one while I lived. And well, I try not to get wet these days. But I hear they are sights to behold.
They are. If the Kaldari are successful, this could help Azeroth greatly. They are also sending sentinels to accompany less militaristic organizations, such as the Explorers League.
This all sounds quite positive, Foul said.
It is, Anduin said. But I think we can do more. I'm going to emulate the Night Elves, and send along some of Stormwind's finest as well. What's happening to the world? We can't afford to lose those who might be able to find a solution to it. I thought I would come back and see how your priests were doing in spreading the word.
Of course, Foul said. I'm proud to say that we've all stepped up to the challenge.
He looked up and beckoned.
Kalia, my dear, won't you come join us?
As Kalia approached them, Foul continued.
She wants so much to help. I've appointed her our liaison to the Alliance Races, whereas I've been familiarizing myself with all kinds of new parts of Azeroth by visiting Horde members. It's been most enlightening.
Kalia now stood beside Anduin, looking from one to the other. It's good to see you again, Anduin, she said.
Our young friend has just returned from Teldrassil, said Thau. He says the Night Elves are already hard at work, and I informed him that we've not been shirking our duties either.
I'm glad to hear it, Anduin said. Actually, I came here hoping to speak with both of you on another topic as well, if we have time.
Ha!
Said Thau, delighted, as Kalia slipped gracefully into the seat beside Anduin.
Sa'ara will be so jealous. Usually everyone comes to see it. As for time, we have nothing but it in this place. It has done the Conclave good not to stay cloistered here, but to be out and about in the world again. Now then, you visited Ironforge and Teldrassil, and it sounds like both have already taken immediate steps.
For the next several minutes, Kalia and Fowl gave Anduin a rundown of where they had traveled and where they had sent others to travel. "We try to take into account whom we're talking to," Kalia said. "For instance, if we're traveling to the Echo Isles, we send one of our trolls. To Tranquillion, a blood elf." "Some have already heard," Kalia said. "And I regret to tell you that some are still more interested in mining the Azerite than in helping Azeroth." Anduin nodded. "Not unexpected, though it's extremely unfortunate," he sighed. "It does sound like we've done what we can. We just have to protect the Azerite as much as possible, and attempt to ensure the Horde doesn't acquire much of it." Even as he said the words, Anduin knew the idea was nothing but wishful thinking. For some reason, the goblins had figured things out first. They had descended on Silithus en masse and set up mines and ways to process the material before Shaw could even report back to Anduin. That battle might be lost already, and the thought pained him. But there might be one way to fight back against the Horde without fighting at all. Anduin had hoped to have Bane quietly helping from the other side, but that was not to be. If this idea was to work, it would be up to Anduin. He folded his hands in front of him and looked from Kalia to Fowl. "I wanted to discuss the Forsaken," he said. "And I apologize in advance if I sound ignorant or insulting." Fowl waved his words away.
"No need at all to apologize. Asking questions is how we learn, and I happen to have some answers."
Despite the Archbishop's assurance, Anduin was convinced he'd sound rude. He was beginning to think that discretion was the better part of valor, and that he'd best be served by excusing himself now.
"I had seen Forsaken before now," he said, "and I was aware that you, were not mindless, raving scourge. I also never thought you were inherently evil."
"But you thought us capable of doing evil things," Fowl said. "Don't worry about that. That's nothing more than being observant. I'll be the first to admit the Forsaken have done terrible things, but so have humans. Even the Tauren have a skeleton or two in their closet, metaphorically speaking, of course."
Anduin grinned, pleased that Fowl understood him, and continued. "I found them less relatable than the other Horde races, even though many used to be human. Perhaps because they used to be human. The Alliance turned them away. People that in life they knew. Maybe even loved." "Fear is a powerful emotion," Kalia said quietly. Something in the tone of her voice, in the way she held her body, brought home to Anduin that her astounding journey of survival had to have been harrowing, perhaps beyond his ability to understand. She sat with her hands in her lap, tightly clasped, and he saw that they trembled. "Kalia," he said before he could stop himself, "how did you possibly survive?" She lifted her sea-blue eyes to his. All over again, he was reminded that she was Arthas's sister, familiar to him, though he had never met her. Her smile was sad. "By fate, and by the light's mercy," she said. "One day I will tell you, but it is still too close. Not just my journey. I lost people I loved, you see." Anduin nodded. "Of course. Your father and brother." It was a painful, ugly story. Arthas, corrupted by the sword Frostborn, and pulled step by step from the path of the light by the whispers of the Lich King, had not simply turned the citizens of Lordaeron into monsters. He had used a public welcoming ceremony as a chance to murder his father as Terranus sat upon his throne. Anduin suddenly, sickly realized that it was possible, no probable, a near certainty, that Kalia Menethil had witnessed that murder. Again, he marveled that she had been able to escape.
"Not just them," Kalia said. "Others I loved as well."
The king's eyes widened. Did she have a family of her own?
"I understand. I'm sorry if I caused you any distress."
He bit his lip, wondering if he should continue. She seemed to sense his dilemma and straightened a little, giving him a wan smile.
"Go ahead. Ask me what you will. I can't promise I'll answer, but I will if I can."
"You had to have had a terrifying experience with the undead," he said quietly.
How is it that you are so close with the Archbishop? Kali relaxed and smiled at her old friend.
He helped save me, she said. I remembered him, you see. And in the midst of all that horror, when I was constantly fleeing so many I loved, whose minds and wills had been stolen from them, to see the face of someone who was still who he had been.
She shook her head, in awe of the moment even now, it would seem.
It was as if hope itself was a sword that stabbed clean through me. Except instead of wounding, it offered me the chance to move through my shock and pain to a place of healing. So you see, for me, the Forsaken weren't monsters. They were friends. It was the scourge, the shambling, stumbling things that wore my friends' faces. They had become monsters.
Fowl appeared genuinely moved by her words, and Anduin wondered if he had ever heard them before. The Archbishop took her hand, patting her healthy human flesh gently with his withered, almost mummified fingers.
"Dear child," he said. His voice was thick, as if with unshed tears. Could Forsaken weep?
Anduin realized that he had no idea. There was so much about them that he didn't know.
"Dear, dear child, the joy was mine at finding you alive."
Anduin was glad he had come. It had been, beyond a doubt, the right decision.
"There's something I'd like to do," he said. "And I'd like the two of you to help me."
"Of course, if we can," Fowl replied.
"A terrible war has come to an end. One that has harmed both Horde and Alliance. Tens of thousands of lives were lost, including those of Vol'jin and my father. Now we hear that our own world might be another casualty, with a precious substance that I cannot in good conscience allow to fall into hostile hands. The goblins certainly know about it, and Sylvanas is probably already plotting how to use it against us. But that's not happened yet. We have an opportunity here to come together, truly come together, and work on a large scale the way the Earthen Ring and the Cenarian Circle do. The way this temple does." They were both listening. They did not scoff at his passion for peace as Greymane did, or regard him with skeptical compassion as Valyra did. Encouraged, Anduin continued. "Already either Sylvanas or other factions have murdered innocent people who have done nothing but try to learn about the world's wound. I have an idea on how we can stop that, but I can't implement it directly. Not yet." He paused. What he was about to say should have grown easier with time, but it had not. "Many believe Sylvanas deliberately betrayed my father and the Alliance at the Broken Shore. No one on our side is going to advocate extending an offer of peace without getting something in return." Fowl looked at him searchingly.
"Do you believe she betrayed King Varian?" he asked calmly.
Anduin thought about Bane's report of the incident.
"I don't know what to believe," he said finally. "But I do know how my advisors, and most of the Alliance, feel about her. She's the enemy. But she's not devoid of the ability to care about one thing, if nothing else."
Kalia looked a bit confused, but Fowl's eyes were bright with understanding.
"I think I see where you're going with this, my boy."
"She cares about the Forsaken. People she views as her children. And the Alliance cares about their fallen loved ones."
Fowl's glowing eyes widened, but it was Kalia who spoke first.
"You're saying that the Alliance was devastated after Lordaeron, because so many of their loved ones were killed, or turned into the Scourge. It was personal loss," she paused. "Like mine."
Anduin nodded.
"Yes," he said quietly. "And they've come to believe that the Forsaken are undead monsters. To most of my people, they're no better than the Scourge. But you know better. You found hope and help from a Forsaken who had been a friend in life, and was still a friend in death."
But Fowl was shaking his head.
"You and Kalia are remarkable individuals, Anduin," he said. "I'm not sure your average human would be able to make the leaps the two of you have."
"That's because they haven't had the chance to," Anduin insisted. "Kalia was rescued by someone she knew and trusted, someone who didn't let her down. At Garrosh Hellscream's trial,
the vision of time showed me another courageous Forsaken. Frandis Farley. There's a Frederick Farley who's the innkeeper in Goldshire. They could be relatives. I wonder if Frederick would like to know that Frandis died resisting a cruel and unfair leader. I'd like to think he would. He leaned forward, speaking from his heart. There have to be so many stories, Fowl. So many. Lordaeron and Stormwind were more than political allies. They were friends. People traveled easily and freely throughout the kingdoms. There have to be relatives who mourn their loved ones as dead, when in reality they're still... The king paused, realizing what he was about to say. Fowl smiled sadly.
Alive? The archbishop shook his head. It's probably a mercy they think them dead. Too many can't shake their prejudice to even try to see us as we really are.
What if they did try? Anduin leaned forward in his seat. What if some of them were open to the idea? To meet their loved ones who've been changed, yes, but still who they were. Isn't that better than their being truly dead?
Not for a great majority, it isn't.
We don't need a majority to begin. Look at Kalia. Look at me. We just need some. We need a spark of understanding, of acceptance. That's all. Just a single spark. His voice trembled as he said it, and he felt the light wash through him with its sweet, warm blessing. Anduin knew he was speaking a great truth, one that would require effort and nurturing, but one that could indeed catch fire and sweep through the world. And when it did, nothing would be the same. I think he's right, Kalia said. Her voice was stronger than it had been since the conversation had begun. There was color in her cheeks, enthusiasm in her face. She was lit from within, as he was, by the breathtakingly daring act of hope. Kalia turned to her friend. I was lost, Alansis. Emotionally, and physically, and mentally. You brought me back from a very dark place. What other wonders could that again work, for both Forsaken and humanity?
I have seen much darkness, Fowl said, and for once he was not warm and quietly mirthful.
He was serious, and the lights in his eyes glowed a different shade as he spoke.
Much, much darkness. There is evil in this world, my young friends. And sometimes, it does not require corruption from an outside source to thrive. Sometimes it is born in the hearts of the least likely-seeming people. A tiny seed of resentment or fear finds fertile soil and blooms into something terrible.
But isn't the reverse also true? Anduin pressed. Can't a tiny seed of hope or kindness find fertile soil as well?
Of course it can. But you are not talking about a tiny seed, Fowl said. First, the only Forsaken you know of who would support such a thing are myself, and a few here in the Conclave. There may not be many others who would. And if there are, you then must work with the leader of the Horde, the Banshee Queen. She may not want her people thinking fondly of their time as living beings. And finally, are there any humans other than Kalia who would even wish to meet their, still existing relatives or friends?
At Anduin's crestfallen expression, the Forsaken Archbishop softened.
I'm sorry to discourage you, but a ruler, even a priestly one, must know all the obstacles in his path. You want what is right, Anduin Lane Rin. And it is my fervent hope that this idea of yours will come to fruition. But perhaps that hour is not now.
Anduin didn't quite slump, but he wanted to. He ran a hand through his hair and sighed. You may be right. But it's a chance to reunite families, to get us all working together so that we're not focused on trying to kill each other. It's a chance to stop the harm to Azeroth. This is important on so many levels.
I didn't say I disagreed with that.
Fowl fell silent for a moment, thinking.
I'll tell you what. I'll talk with